Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome again to our Uxer Brown Bag series. We're really happy to welcome Tracy Newman from Wayne State today. I'm Sabina Dietrich, and director of the Urban and Regional Analysis Program here. My colleagues are here, Chris Bream, our regional economist, and Bob's somewhere, Bob Graddick, of course, who puts all this together with such good scheduling. I know we've had two back-to-backs for people who were here last week with Claudia Colton, but we're happy to see you again. Tracy has been in Pittsburgh since what, Wednesday,
yes.
And gave her paper also at the Heinz History Center.
It was a different paper.
Yes.
Two papers.
That's right, it was two papers to historians. So today we're going to learn about Pittsburgh and Hamilton, Ontario, and a lot of you know about Hamilton, and she's going to do her comparison on the two. She's assistant professor in the history at Wayne State University, and her research explores 20th century U.S. social and political history, comparative urban history, policy history, and transnational and global approaches to U.S. history. She's finishing her book on the post-industrial transformation of North American cities and the emergence of the neoliberal urbanism of the late 20th century. Tracy, welcome to Uxer, and we look forward to your talk.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay? Is this even on? But can you
I don't know if it's, yeah.
Do you need it on? I don't need it on, but if other people do, I kind of hate them. They make me nervous. But if you want one, okay. So I'm just going to move that out of my way then. And if you can't hear me, tell Bob, and he can come fix things. So I want to thank Bob and Sabina for inviting me today, and thank everyone for coming out in this sort of terrible weather to hear my talk. I'm really thrilled to be here, and I have seemed a little nervous too, because this and the talk I did at the Heinz History Center on Wednesday are my first two efforts to present my research on Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh. I talk about Pittsburgh everywhere else, but I came here for the Urban Affairs Conference last year and chickened out and just talked about Hamilton. So it's, you know, it's nice to be in front of sort of a hometown crowd. I think I'm kind of unique, at least among historians who write about Pittsburgh. I'm not from Pennsylvania. I did not go to school at Pitt. I'm from Northern Michigan, actually. So I did not grow up steeped in sort of the deindustrialization that I'm writing about here, which I think sometimes gives me a nice outsider's view and also sometimes leads me to make factual errors. So feel free to comment on any of those that you catch. So today what I'm going to talk about is essentially drawn from one chapter of the book that I'm working on. It's tentatively titled Remaking the Rust Belt, and it has a very long subtitle that I can never even remember, but it's sort of 1968 to 2000. And I thought I'd take a few minutes at the outset to talk about the larger project to give you a little context for what I'm going to spend my time talking about. So the thing I am going to spend most of the time talking about is neighborhood redevelopment on the south side compared to the north end of Pittsburgh, which is where Pittsburgh-Hamilton's urban steel mills were. Obviously, I write about two steel towns, Pittsburgh and Hamilton. In the book, I'm trying to make an argument about the relationship between the emergence of post-industrial urban visions of growth coalitions, developmentalist mayors in the late 20th century, and the development of what sort of social science literature, particularly geographers and sociologists, are calling neoliberal urbanism or neoliberal urban governance. And I'm trying to make an argument, or I hope I'm making an argument, that these things are emerging parallel. And to make my case, like I said, I look at redevelopment strategies in the U.S. and Canada broadly, but it's grounded in these case studies of Pittsburgh and Hamilton. So Pittsburgh and Hamilton's urban development were historically very similar. Both were centers of steel production for their respective countries. Both experienced an erosion of their manufacturing bases after World War II. The smokestacks, of course, that dominated Pittsburgh's rivers and Hamilton's harbor were historically symbols of wealth and power when being an industrial country was what you wanted to be. By the 1980s, they had become symbols of environmental degradation and urban decay. Pittsburgh and Hamilton's political and business elites anticipated and indeed facilitated industrial restructuring as early as the 1960s. They led efforts to remake economic activity through extensive redevelopment schemes that privileged remaking downtown as a center for kind of managing capital rather than managing production. They remade residential neighborhoods that were built to support a manufacturing-based economy, and launched kind of extensive marketing campaigns that promoted their idealized visions of what their post-industrial cities would look like. So in both places, residents, neighborhood groups, labor organizations challenged these post-industrial urban visions, But also in both places, they weren't terribly successful, and a pretty powerful social and spatial imaginary of post-Steele white-collar jobs came to dominate land use plans, public discourse, and economic development initiatives. So just, again, to give you a little bit of a sense about the context for the larger project, the existing literature in urban studies on post-war cities talks about the rise and decline between 1945 and the late 1960s of what historian Chris Klemek has recently dubbed the urban renewal order, which is a phrase I've decided I like, so I'm sticking with it, that's tied to growth liberalism or the Keynesian state after World War II. And then there's kind of a leap in the literature to talk about the emergence of so-called neoliberal cities in the 1980s. And so part of what I'm trying to do is deal with that transition between the decline of this urban renewal order and the rise of whatever the new thing is. If it's neoliberal, it's neoliberal. I'm not sure I love that term, but that's kind of what I'm working with. And so at a very basic level, this literature on neoliberal cities is very much like older scholarship on post-Fordist cities. It rests on the assumption that there was a rupture in the organization of global capitalism at some point in the 1970s, and that urban design and urban spatial relations in the late 20th century and today reflect that break, that there's a causal relationship between the two. So in short, this neoliberal cities literature argues that there's a crisis of capital that leads to disinvestment in the industrial mode of production, and the emergence of flexible production models and a service and finance based, urban economies that are service and finance based instead of manufacturing based. So national governments and financial elites in this model use tactics like deregulation, privatization, devolution to create a neoliberal order, a kind of turn to market orthodoxy. Urban sociologists and geographers have also argued that cities pretty quickly become the major testing grounds for this new, for neoliberal policy experiments. So the specific tactics that scholars in urban studies describe as typical of neoliberal urbanism are things like capital subsidies, place promotion, urban branding, supply-side intervention and incentives to corporations, central city makeovers, these kinds of things that sound to historians and probably to anyone who is involved with planning or public policy, like pretty familiar tools for urban regeneration that go back to, you can argue the late 19th century at least. But the argument here is that they take on a kind of new valence in the context of trying to dismantle the welfare state and replace it with market-oriented solutions to urban problems, particularly through the creation of public-private partnerships. So these familiar tactics that I mentioned are being used in new ways with different intentions and with a different set of institutional arrangements is kind of the argument that geographers and sociologists are making here. By the 1980s, a consensus had emerged among policymakers, at least at the national level in both the US and Canada, that public incentives for private sector economic and urban redevelopment projects weren't just the best way, but really the only way to confront urban problems. And part of this is coming about, as a response to trying to deal with the so-called urban crisis in the US in the late 1960s. Canada has its own urban crisis. It's the inverse. They pick up the language, but really they are worried about population booms in cities instead of population loss from cities. But they are talking about these things in much the same way. So the larger project that I'm working on, the book project, like I said, is trying to explain this transition from an urban renewal order to this neoliberal order, neoliberal urbanism, and to historicize the development of urban policy tactics that decentralize and privatize urban governance in the last half of the 20th century. What I'm hoping to do with the book is challenge both the temporal and spatial assumptions that underlie theorizations of neoliberal cities, to challenge this presumed causality between economic crisis and spatial change that's so prevalent in that literature. I argue that in old industrial centers, places like Pittsburgh and Hamilton, but also places like Sheffield, England, or Detroit, or the Ruhr Valley, that changes to local economies, to the built environment, and to the social relations might better be understood as an acceleration and intensification of processes that had been underway since at least the late 50s, early 60s, if not the end of World War II. And that they're not something, actually, that's emerging as a response to a particular moment of crisis in the 1970s or out of some sort of neoliberal political project in the 1980s, Reagan or Thatcher. So that's the bigger project that I'm working on. And today I want to situate the relationship between post-industrial cities and neoliberal urbanism and the post-war history of neighborhood redevelopment in Pittsburgh and Hamilton. So I'm finally going to show you where Hamilton is. I probably could have pulled this up a little earlier. So we all know where we are, presumably. Hamilton is about 300 miles north. It takes about 6 hours to drive there. And let's see. There we go. This is the Toronto metropolitan area up here. So Hamilton's about 45 minutes south of Toronto. Chris noted that he made the mistake of referring to it as a suburb of Toronto, and nobody was very happy about it. It does essentially today function as a suburb of Toronto, and kind of the way that the Poconos function as a suburb of New York City, but nobody in Hamilton wants to hear that. So economic development studies in Pittsburgh and Hamilton in the late 1950s and early 1960s demonstrate that urban and regional planners were already thinking about planning cities that wouldn't be so heavily reliant on heavy manufacturing as they were during the war and before World War II. Planners pursued economic diversification. They believed that manufacturing jobs were likely to decline in importance in each city in the broader region that they were part of. They understood that service sector jobs would eventually dominate local employment, and they knew that their reputations as industrial cities, as smoky cities, were hindering their capacity to attract growth industries. They pursued urban development strategies to some extent based on existing land use plan. They pulled things off the shelf that had been underway since before World War II, but they were also looking at each other and at troubled manufacturing centers in Europe and other parts of North America for ideas. And like I said, I'm going to focus today on urban redevelopment in the residential neighborhoods near each city's primary steel mills. And then, since I'm actually in Pittsburgh, of course, you know there were mills in Hazelwood, too. I talk about Hazelwood in the larger project, but in the interest of time, the north end and south side present a kind of neat comparison, too neat, really. So I'm admitting that it's too neat of a comparison that I'm leaving out Hazelwood in the story for now, but I'd be happy to talk about how it fits in later on. So they, in both places, right, the downtown redevelopment projects are really what they're focused on. This is what the mayor's offices in both places see is kind of essential to projecting an image of a post-industrial space, having a gleaming downtown of headquarters buildings. And in both of these cities, the mill neighborhoods kind of present a problem for the mayors. You've got these urban steel mills. What are you going to do about them? How are you going to contend with the physical sites of production that are still operating in your city when, in residential neighborhoods around them, when what you're trying to do is convince everyone that you're post-industrial? And so in Pittsburgh, of course, the mills eventually shut down on the south side, and this helps facilitate this process. It becomes much easier to contend with and close down steel mills than actually operating steel mills. In Hamilton, that didn't happen. The steel mills in Hamilton, I think, are still not producing anything, but that's only been about true since about 2010. So through the entire period I talk about, they're actually producing steel in Hamilton and a lot of steel. They're employing only a fraction of the manufacturing base that they used to have, but they're still producing more steel than they did after World War II. Then U.S. Steel bought out one of the big mills and shut it down, and that's that kind of story. But Hamilton was just as committed to trying to figure out how to disguise the fact that manufacturing had ever existed in the city as Pittsburgh was, even though they still had steel mills working. So, presumably you're all familiar with the South Side, but I thought I'd pull up a map of it also. So the key actors in the South Side's redevelopment between the late 1960s and the early 1980s, so while the JNL, the LTV mills were still operational, weren't city officials. They were members of nonprofit and neighborhood-based organizations. City planners were pretty preoccupied with projects downtown or in more troubled neighborhoods, and they didn't take very much interest in the South Side. They judged it a stable, if declining, neighborhood. It didn't seem like the best use of resources. Before the LTV mill shut down, actually, the strongest programmatic statement of interest in the neighborhood from the planning department or from the mayor's office was an assessment that the East Carson Street commercial district required what they've described as some level of revitalization. So it was a very tepid kind of statement. They were funneling some money over there, but this was not an area of major interest. And what emerged to carry out that revitalization instead of, you know, federal programs or local or state programs was a neighborhood-based planning process that was driven by social service organizations, historic preservationists, community development corporations, and the South Side's small business owners. It was a process that I'm trying to argue largely resisted gentrification until the 1990s, or was at least struggling to resist gentrification until the 1990s. With the city government and the corporate sector sort of disengaged and these multiple civic groups involved in trying to figure out how to make sure that the South Side remained a dynamic neighborhood, redevelopment on the South Side was pretty ad hoc and resident-focused, at least through about 1980. So as early as 1968, Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation proclaimed the quote that they, the promotional literature said, the South Side's future is in its past. So in 68, this is pretty unusual nationally for a neighborhood to be this focused on historic preservation. And Landmarks stressed historically sensitive, of course, redevelopment that would restore existing buildings and retain the existing residents. Its staff provided technical advice to property owners. They worked to try and figure out how to get historic preservation funds for rehabilitation, this sort of thing. Southside civic organizations also benefited from a turn towards neighborhood-based community development during Pete Flaherty's mayoral tenure. In 1972, after President Richard Nixon froze federal urban development funds and he effectively terminated urban renewal, there was this sort of housing moratorium. The mayor's office announced that it was going to use any new community development funds that became available from the federal government to support existing neighborhoods, rather than to either expand or restart urban renewal projects that were canceled or paused when Nixon instituted the funding freeze. So Pete Flaherty establishes something called the Neighborhood Commercial Improvement Program in 1975 as the centerpiece of this new neighborhood strategy or new neighborhood stabilization program. He invoked the rhetoric of public-private partnerships, and the city planning department became very enamored of this in this period, admonishing, you know, residents of Pittsburgh that the success of government programs rested on them, on individuals who must decide to reinvest in their homes and businesses, and that, you know, they couldn't be looking to government to solve all of these things for them. Southside business owners took advantage of this neighborhood community investment programs, low-interest loans for building improvements, grants for storefront design, and public space improvement funds to renovate existing businesses that served the neighborhood's largely working-class residents. By 1978, when the Southside Chamber of Commerce compiled a guide to help business owners find funding for historically sensitive building improvements, the planning department had begun to privilege conservation and rehabilitation as the city's primary approach to neighborhood development. And part of this reflects a shift under the Carter administration towards, you know, national urban policy based on neighborhood conservation. So this is where federal funds are available as well. Planners emphasized that such an approach promised to attract new residents to Pittsburgh, but they insisted that retaining existing residents and maintaining the homes of the existing residents was their priority, not, you know, that secondarily they wanted to attract new residents, but really this was about the existing residents. Southside Civic Organization heeded the planners' call for a partnership, and, you know, they thought this partnership-based approach to redevelopment was a way to really control neighborhood development, if only to ensure, really, that neighborhood residents received even basic services. So the Southside Chamber of Commerce, for instance, bought street cleaning equipment and hired a part-time cleaner to maintain East Carson Street because the city had stopped maintaining the streets. Even as neighborhood-based planning exercises, though, moved toward this public-private partnership model, Southside's civic groups were kind of explicitly resisting gentrification. They were continuing to work to meet the needs of existing residents. They were talking very much about the elderly population, making sure people weren't going to be driven out of their homes. But Southside residents by the early 1980s had reason to doubt that the city planners, at least, were legitimately interested in what they wanted or what their visions for the neighborhood were. And again, this is when the city government kind of wholesale eliminates non-essential services at the neighborhood level and focuses on downtown redevelopment. So shortly after the Southside Works, the steel mill Southside Works, not the mall, Southside Works, shut down in 1981, the Chamber of Commerce formed the Southside Local Development Corporation, the SSLDC, which I think just closed shop last summer and has sent its papers somewhere, which I'm very excited about since I couldn't get into them before. And so the SSLDC had these dual goals of economic development and historic preservation. That was sort of their founding mission. And it seems like the members of the SSLDC understood these as interrelated projects from the outset, that these were not two separate tracks, that one would bring about the other. The members of the Southside Chamber of Commerce, the neighborhood small business owners, service providers, also seemed to understand themselves to be creating a planning body that was going to do what the city government wouldn't, produce historically sensitive planning guidelines for the South Side. So while the SSLDC received some funding from the city government, donations from the Chamber of Commerce and its members sustained the organization, at least in its early years. The SSLDC represented not so much a public-private partnership in the sense that we might think about that now, as the privatization and decentralization to the neighborhood level of city planning functions and economic development. And again, this begins sort of coincident with the shutdown at the mill site. And again, also, I should note, this is the type of privatization that scholars cite as evidence of neoliberal urbanism, this kind of offloading of planning functions to the neighborhood level. So the SSLDC was charged with creating an economic development plan for a neighborhood in which both income and population declined between 1960 and 1980. I recognize I could be talking about almost any Pittsburgh neighborhood when I say that. The commercial district as well as residential areas were showing signs of physical deterioration. There were high commercial vacancy rates. They were about 40% by 1985. And the South Side, you know, was declining according to the planning department, but the South Side Local Development Corporation saw this in very different terms. Its first director, one of only two employees at the time, told the Post-Gazette that the neighborhood had really remained strong, even though there were a lot of vacant storefronts. Don Carlson was the first director, and he said he could barely manage to return all of the calls he was receiving from people who were interested in buying or renting space on the South Side. And he insisted that this was in part due to their historic preservation approach, that there were historic preservation tax credits available to small business owners, and they found this very appealing. So East Carson Street's historic district designation, according to Carlson and other people who were involved, really helped create a theme for Southside redevelopment and a method of marketing the area. And this reinforced a locally generated development strategy that had been underway since the late 1960s. In early 1984, and this is still with very high commercial vacancy rates, the Post-Gazette ran an optimistic feature on the South Side's resurgence. Carlson told the journalist who wrote that story that the South Side was facing a key moment of change. So, as I've been saying, they've been resisting gentrification on the South Side at this point. They seem sort of conscious of the fact that they could displace residents. Even though there are a lot of vacancies, they want to make sure that people don't feel like they're going to have to move. And Carlson underscored that there was a good rapport among the Southside residents and SSLDC. SSLDC didn't want to change the neighborhood's ethnic mixture or working class character. But in spite of his desires to emphasize the ways in which the neighborhood had stayed the same, even he had to admit it wasn't the same Southside that had been there 30 years prior. The mix of residents and businesses had already changed. Existing businesses and longtime residents hadn't been forced out in the way we might think of with gentrification today, but they had left for various reasons, and the composition of the neighborhood commercial district was beginning to change to include shops and restaurants that were geared towards suburbanites, as they were replacing the ones that were shutting down. And the idea here, right, SSLDC, it's a tongue twister for me, wanted to make East Carson Street a regional attraction, not just a neighborhood attraction. So as historic preservation had been pretty firmly established as the South Side's engine of economic and physical development, when in 1985 a group of civic, religious, educational, and social service organizations established the South Side Planning Forum, which I think is still operational, unlike SSLDC, right? Yeah. At the outset, like SSLDC, the Planning Forum resisted gentrification very explicitly. They talked about neighborhood-based planning efforts, remained very attuned to the interests of existing residents. The director of the Main Street program and a planning forum member emphasized that development should ensure that commercial services catering to the residential community remain in place. Even if they were bringing in a new mix of commercial enterprises to attract people in, they needed to make sure that there was a place for people to buy groceries and socks and these sorts of things. All of the community development groups involved at the planning forum were really focused on keeping housing affordable for the elderly residents of the neighborhood. However much SSLDC and the Planning Forum participants spoke of their desire to meet the service needs of existing residents, though, both organizations by the mid-80s were very clearly hoping to attract new, younger residents to the area to replace the workers and young families who left the South Side and the region more broadly when the steel mills closed down. So their strategy was threefold. They wanted to first attract new low and moderate income residents to the neighborhood. Second, they wanted to retain the existing population. And third, they wanted to create new types of economic activity that they thought would bring employees and customers to the South Side from outside of the neighborhood. SSLDC staffers argued that establishing a balanced residential population was the most important thing. This was more important than creating jobs on the South Side. They thought that, you know, South Side residents may not work in the neighborhood, and the people who worked in the neighborhood may not necessarily spend money in the neighborhood if they just happen to be there working during the day. But if you could get people living in the South Side, they would shop in the businesses, they would go to the restaurants, they would sustain the drugstores. So this became their goal. And Southside residents initially seemed to support SSLDC's efforts to revitalize the neighborhood, because the members of the SSLDC and the Planning Forum were working very hard to meet the housing and service needs of the existing and like in large, the aging population. But this model remained tenable only as long as residential and commercial vacancy rates remained high. And as those things started to get a little tighter moving into the 1990s, the conflict started to come out between these organizations and the older residents. So I said that the City Planning Department had been taking kind of a hands-off approach to the South Side redevelopment. They were doing some things. The city government funded a riverfront park right along the Monongahela River between 17th and 27th Streets, I think, in the mid-1980s. I'm not actually sure the name of that park. You guys actually probably know. But this opens access to the river on the South Side. The city did fund and administer programs that subsidized commercial district revitalization efforts. But for the most part, planners and the mayor's office were content to leave the management and oversight and development of these projects to the neighborhood planning organizations. This was in part because the development activity already underway was exemplary of the type of partnership the city government was trying to foster in neighborhoods throughout the city, where civic groups and individual property owners organized, planned, and largely privately financed the redevelopment of commercial districts and residential areas. But also, of course, because the city development funds and the mayor's attentions were focused on these large-scale downtown redevelopment projects. That's the way they were putting their money, the cultural district on the north side and downtown. The city government's hands-off approach to the South Side ended when the steel mill finally shut down. There'd been a few, you know, things still running until the late 1980s. And there's probably, you're mostly familiar with this, a pretty interesting story about efforts to reindustrialize the mills that failed rather dramatically, that, again, figures largely prominently into the larger project, but I'm not going to talk about too much today, because the upshot that's important for what I'm talking about today is that it fails. There's an effort to reindustrialize, it fails. It fails in part because Tom Murphy steps in and the city government makes sure that this cannot happen. There seems to be some debate about how reasonable the plan was in the first place, but I am not going to weigh in on that. So SSLDC unveils its own plan for mill site redevelopment after the reindustrialization plan fails, and you can sort of see it here. It doesn't, the mixed-use nature is very similar to what you actually end up with, but they wanted something that wasn't like the mall in Homestead. They wanted to see something different happening than the kind of planning that was going on for Homestead at the time. And they pretty explicitly rejected any industrial uses on the site, aside from a little area for light industry, but no heavy industrial uses, because its members deemed manufacturing increasingly obsolete and no longer representative of the community's character. To complement their own economic development activities on East Carson Street, the SSLDC wanted to see the mill site converted from mixed-use residential and commercial space with access to and across the river. And so, like I said, this doesn't, you know, if you look at this, the plan is a little bit different than what you see there today, but the intention is roughly similar. But SSLDC staffers talked about two distinct markets on the South Side. They wanted to see these sorts of services for residents and non-residents. While SSLDC members promoted incremental economic and demographic changes on the South Side, the organization did acknowledge that those changes were you know, requiring residents to make pretty difficult adjustments, long-time residents. SSLDC staffers wrote that the community was changing. But what they meant was that the steel mill that dominated the east end of the neighborhood had been demolished, and city officials had renewed their interest in controlling Southside development. With the question of reindustrialization pretty much foreclosed, the SSLDC and the Southside Chamber of Commerce no longer really had to consider manufacturing workers part of the community, or at least the economic needs of manufacturing workers as far as jobs go, part of the community, which these groups were increasingly beginning to describe in terms of economic activity rather than the social character of the neighborhood. So this is when I sort of, you know, say that the desire to resist gentrification fades away. Using language that sounds very much light-coded language for state-sponsored gentrification, the SSLDC issued a set of informal recommendations that stressed the need to open the South Side to new socioeconomic groups while retaining the neighborhood's character and continuing to serve existing residents. The SSLDC noted the emergence of an evolving and controversial economic development strategy focused on serving markets beyond the immediate neighborhood. This meant that housing development on the former mill site should be predominantly owner-occupied and address the housing needs of middle and upper-income young families, and that the retail uses that went on that site should attract a regional consumer base, not just a neighborhood consumer base. So there had been some notion that maybe this could be low-income housing, and pretty much everyone agreed that that was not what they wanted to see on this site. So where SSLDC's members had initially encouraged a mix of businesses for a host of different types of residents, by the early 1990s, they were primarily looking to create businesses and services for non-residents or for imaginary residents that they hoped would move to the neighborhood if they had these businesses. So again, I'm not going to take the time today to talk about the Southside Works mall development, because I'm assuming everyone is intimately familiar with that. But that is sort of the outcome of the efforts between SSLDC and the Planning Forum to negotiate what's going to happen on this site with the city. And of course, what you end up with is this. This is always my favorite slide to show, because Pittsburgh provides such an easy joke about, you know, converting sites of production to sites of consumption. Also, it seems that every time you go out to lunch with someone who used to be kind of do anything for the Steelworkers Union, they want to take you to the Cheesecake Factory so they can talk about what it used to be. So I spent a lot of time there when I was doing research. So Hamilton is a different story altogether, and this is Hamilton's North End. These three things that are on here are three urban renewal plans that began in the 1960s but didn't finish up until the 1980s. So the North End is the largest of those. The Civic Square is the downtown redevelopment, and the York Street redevelopment is an entertainment district, essentially. And redevelopment in Hamilton's North End took place in a very different context than Southside's redevelopment in Pittsburgh. Until the 1990s, right, I was saying, in Pittsburgh, social welfare and civic groups
Where are the mills, just to that?
The mills are over here. This is the mill stuff. Sorry. whereas I was saying that it was sort of nonprofits, community groups that were carrying out the redevelopment in Pittsburgh until the early 1990s, from the outset, this was an urban renewal plan. Beginning in 1958, the city had decided this needed to be an urban renewal area, and they had an urban renewal scheme drawn up by, I think this is 1963. Yeah, 1963, they had a plan drawn up. So the North End redevelopment conformed to a master plan created under the auspices of local and provincial officials who wanted to make it one of the city's more desirable neighborhoods, which seems puzzling now, the idea that you are going to take the neighborhood next to the steel mills and make it the highest income luxury housing in the city does not seem intuitive, right? But at the time, this is what they wanted to do. The city government wanted to use this renewal plan to realign the North End residential district with downtown, which is why there's this sort of connection through the York Street Entertainment District. And the idea is that it's going to create this new sort of mental map of the city where this is part of this instead of part of this, if that makes sense, where you're supposed to think of the North End as part of the commercial district and not as part of the industrial district. So the city government, again, is leading the charge here, and as was the case with their downtown redevelopment plans in Hamilton, they were very attuned to making sure they were meeting the needs of their existing residents, but also trying to draw in new white-collar residents. I mentioned that they don't like to be considered a suburb of Toronto. That's because Hamilton always saw itself very much in competition with Toronto for businesses and residents. Toronto did not feel that competition very much. They did not think they were competing with Hamilton in the least, but sort of like a German Shepherd and a Chihuahua or something. So the North End was one of the city's earliest settled neighborhoods. And it was, by the 1960s, a kind of prime example of what planners called blighted housing in the early, mid-20th century. Part of the problem was that the industrial uses along the harbor over there were starting to drift over into the North End, even though it was supposed to be a residential district. And wealthier residents moved out. And so it became one of these kind of classic transitional neighborhoods where whatever new immigrant group moves to the city always moves into the North End, both because it's near industry and because it's the declining housing stock, even though it has lovely kind of Victorian homes. So most of the neighbors' more modest housing, one- and two-story homes, dated from the late 19th and early 20th century. They were grand houses from the 1860s that had been subdivided into apartments. Many of the residences had small yards, they lacked driveways, they didn't seem like places where people with cars wanted to live. And again, they required sort of minor maintenance or cosmetic improvements, and all of these were the things that the planners cited as evidence of blight. Planners also characterized the commercial buildings along James Street, which I don't know if you can see on here, it's in there, which is the major commercial district in the North End, as blighted as well. They said they were almost invariably old, the buildings. They weren't necessarily declining, they were just old. And they described the North End's commercial enterprises as purely local, and this was a problem. The annual sales for the commercial district totaled only 30% of the average for other commercial districts in the city. So there were no entertainment industries, there were no theaters or bowling alleys, these sorts of things in the early 1960s, which meant that all of the spending by North End residents for leisure activities or for shopping happened outside of the neighborhood. And this is what the planners were hoping to change. So redevelopment of the James Street Commercial District was intended to better serve the community's needs so they would be investing in their neighborhood. But there was also a notion that they were over here on this nice waterfront land going to create space for new kinds of residents, and you would need different kinds of commercial space for them as well. So in the years between the city's decision to make this North End renewal project a priority in about 1961 and the completion of this scheme that you see here, this is a midway scheme in 1963, they finish it in 1968, city officials, private developers, and individual homeowners just began moving forward with projects anyway. They were expecting that they were going to get funding for this. In 1963, the Hamilton City Council adopted interim guidelines for the renewal area, and these were intended to meet two goals. They wanted to improve the housing stock and boost the city's economy by spurring new commercial development. They hoped that they would be able to spend $9 million enticing private developers to improve the housing for blue-collar workers, for middle-class residents, and then to develop luxury housing on the harbor. So again, this was all supposed to become luxury housing.
Tracy?
Yes?
Can you point out if there are any railways or highways?
Oh, that is next. There's no highways up there at this point, and the railways run... Where the heck are the railways? There are railways running through, and I'm not sure I can do it, honestly. But there are railways that go through, and I cannot tell you...
Do they act as a...
They're running over to the industry, yeah. Right. So there's this kind of over in here. They've got something that they call residential enclaves, where there's a little pocket of heavy industry in the rail yards, and it connects over to the industry on the harbor. So part of it was trying to figure out a way to run a road that would cut that off from the rest of the neighborhood and maybe move the rail lines a bit. Yeah, sorry about that. I do not have the best maps for this project, and I can never remember where the railroads ran. So they want $9 million in improvement sort of land servicing that's going to attract private developers. So like in Pittsburgh, from the outset of the plan, the planners imagined different types of residents coexisting in the North End, not in mixed-income developments, though. The idea here isn't that you're going to have mixed-income areas. You're going to have spatially segregated areas within that one neighborhood that are designed to serve different types of residents. By 1965, city officials had selected sites for public housing, parks, and schools, and they had begun acquiring the substandard housing slated for demolition. By 1968, they built a new school, one public housing facility for the elderly, and one privately developed high-rise. And they had sort of a new neighborhood center that was nearing completion. That was all they sort of managed to do by that point. And residents were getting very concerned. Of course, they have a good 7 years here from the announcement of this urban renewal scheme till when the funding comes through to think about the fact that their houses are going to be expropriated and perhaps torn down. So they got the Hamilton Urban Renewal Department was receiving 250 inquiries a year from North End homeowners asking about aid for home repairs and trying to figure out what they could do to their homes to get them reclassified as not blighted. And it seems that the Urban Renewal Department was not particularly savvy about this because they did things like give them loans and give them advice on how to fix things up. And so half of the houses that the city thought it was going to tear down had to be reclassified as not blighted, which it's not totally clear what they were doing, but they seem to be working at cross purposes here. But residents clearly didn't want to leave the neighborhood. So industry stymies these plans, basically. In the late 1960s, planners were complaining that industrial uses still monopolized the waterfront. There was limited public access. They understood why this was, because there were steel mills there, but that this wasn't exemplary or admirable. They hired some consultants who came in to try and help them figure out what to do about this. And the consultants predicted that the North End would be able to attract 300 privately developed high-rise apartments per year, which may sound sort of ludicrous, but at the time, they seemed to think this was reasonable. They based this on population predictions, extrapolations from recent high-rise development in Toronto, which is, of course, a very different kind of city. And planners decided that the North End could house nearly 12,000 people, at least 40% of them in luxury apartments. City officials did not offer incentives, however, to private developers. They don't work in Canada the way we work in the U.S. The province of Ontario made it illegal for cities to essentially engage in any kind of interurban competition, so they wouldn't allow city governments to provide tax incentives or development incentives. They could service land, they could landscape, they could build parking, that was about it. And because they couldn't provide these kinds of incentives, and because Hamilton was actually very focused on making sure that the existing residents weren't displaced, even when that worked at odds with their kind of vision for redevelopment, they were not very successful in getting people to build these luxury apartments. By the end of the 1960s, like I said, only one of these luxury apartment complexes had materialized. And in 1970, the federal government terminated its financial support for this urban renewal project. So they lost half of their projected funding when the federal government terminated the urban renewal project. And this came on the heels of a revised scheme which asked for an additional $19 million over 10 years to realize what they were doing. Somehow losing all of the federal funding and needing another $20 million didn't slow city officials down. They were still really interested in pursuing this project, but they decided that they needed more private redevelopment if they were going to be able to do it. But again, they can't provide incentives to lure people in, and this doesn't materialize. So in the end, they only had the $9 million that they started out with, you know, that they predicted in 1961. By 1970, of course, this environment has changed dramatically. And this elimination of the federal renewal funds, I think, marks a really important difference between redevelopment in the North End and in Pittsburgh's South Side. The South Side community groups were receiving really limited public funding anyways. They were getting some. They were getting, you know, they probably got urban development action grants. They got community development block grants, these kinds of things. But they were largely left to their own devices until the 1990s, at which point the city decided to take an interest. And it therefore was kind of impervious to the vagaries of federal funding and federal urban development initiatives. In Hamilton, though, because this had been a publicly planned and undertaken endeavor, they were really reliant on these federal urban renewal funds, and it was devastating to them when they lost them. There was just no way they were going to be able to realize their vision for the area. So after the federal government pulled their funding, the Growth Coalition's vision for this revitalized North End unraveled pretty quickly. At the same time, North End residents were really beginning to voice their dissatisfaction with the project. So in 1970, when it became apparent that they weren't going to get this $20 million, the planning board chair in the North End wrote to the city and said that he was very frustrated with what the city was doing in the neighborhood. And the city responded that they were very frustrated with the North End residents trying to stand in their way. when a group of residents protested the potential expropriation of their homes for a high-rise luxury development on the harbor, the chair of the planning board informed them rather tersely that the city was not going to allow the interests of a few residents to prevent change that the city government thought was in the best interest of the city as a whole, noting, quote, "Perhaps the strong arm of the city may have to be exercised," which is somewhat of an empty threat, actually, in Hamilton, because the strong arm of the city is not really that strong. So the city planning director, this guy Bob Bailey, ominously informed residents that the city government was going to step in and persuade them. He kept talking about the various ways the city had to persuade them, which sounds, you know, sort of like they were going to bring the mob in, to sell once a developer had acquired at least 80% of the land required for any projects that planners wanted to see completed. And when, you know, when residents demanded from Bailey to know whether or not he was representing their interest or the interest of developers, he told them it was both, right? That they may see him as, you know, their employee, but he was equally beholden to these Toronto area developers that he was trying to attract. So by 1977, the North End had organized. They had this North End Residential Organization, which was one of the few such organizations in the city, and they conducted their own survey of residents' attitudes about the renewal program, which had been underway for 20 years at this point and done very little except for build, you know, a school, a housing complex, and tear down some buildings. The survey respondents were pretty unhappy. 80% of them said they were very dissatisfied with the course taken by the city with the renewal program. And they thought that it had diminished any sense of community spirit and cohesiveness. But their primary complaint was that the city government was relocating local businesses, particularly a hardware store and a grocery store, this was almost universally what they complained about, out of the commercial district, because they thought that they were going to bring in these higher-end shops to serve the luxury apartments. So they made the move before they had anything to replace them, and nothing ever never did. They were supposed to bring in chain grocery store. It never came. They thought they were going to bring in a different kind of, you know, fancier drugstore, which never came. They never built the mall they were going to build. So essentially, they just ripped apart this neighborhood in a very familiar kind of urban renewal story. The neighborhood survey found that residents remained angry with what they saw also as an inequitable financial burden imposed on North Edmonton by the city government. So this is not the poorest neighborhood in the city, but definitely one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. And this woman, Alice Lupton, who lived in the North End and was the director of the neighborhood organization, kept talking about this building code project. In 1970, the city had implemented a building code project, and they decided to use the North End as their test area for it. And what this meant was that they, you know, they fined the hell out of everyone in the North End for all of these minor building code problems, and then they decided it didn't make any sense and didn't fine anyone else in the rest of the city. So they kept using these kind of it as sort of a laboratory for figuring out what to do elsewhere, and it became very expensive trying to force people to keep up these homes based on codes that weren't really very reasonable. So North End residents, they didn't really object to the city government's larger vision for a post-industrial city. They didn't care what they were doing downtown. They didn't particularly mind bringing in luxury housing as long as they weren't displaced for it. Instead, their outrage really centered on city and provincial officials' failure to deliver basic neighborhood services and physical improvements that they'd promised them in this urban renewal scheme. So Lupton, the woman who runs this North End planning organization or neighborhood organization, she charged the planners with what I think a lot of neighborhood groups think planners are doing. Probably the Southside residents thought the same thing, which was that she said the planners were sitting at City Hall working with a map and a bunch of pins and sticking them in without thinking of the people who live there. They don't see people as human beings. And this was the complaint of the neighborhoods. At least one city official actually agreed with her. The building commissioner responded and said that in his estimation, that the renewal scheme was actually hindering construction in the North End, and that these demonstration programs had been very unfair to the North End residents. Furthermore, he pointed out that the North End was a really unattractive financial risk to developers because it had a low residential population, and it had an unflattering reputation as a declining neighborhood that had been in the process of renewal for 20 years. What remained, essentially, was that Hamilton's Growth Coalition had very few tools with which to work to make the neighborhood more appealing to private sector developers. So unlike Pittsburgh city officials who eventually are able to step in, to coordinate the Southside redevelopment and advance pretty lucrative incentives to developers. The Southside Works is, of course, heavily publicly subsidized. Hamilton city officials couldn't do that. They couldn't offer any kind of capital subsidy development in the North End. They couldn't do it for downtown redevelopment. They remained far more attentive to the needs of the North End's existing residents, even if those residents were angry with them, they listened to their complaints, than, you know, perhaps Pittsburgh's city officials did when they decided to get involved in the South Side. But this didn't actually translate to improved services for the working class residents of the neighborhood. Urban renewal officials had predicted at the outset of the planning process that the North End was, you know, going to regain its historic prominence as a fashionable residential district. And they saw, you know, redevelopment in Toronto and many American cities, Pittsburgh actually being one of them, as a precedent. And they thought, you know, again, this proximity to downtown and this new entertainment district, this is going to entice people to move there. But none of these things happened, even though, you know, they're kind of doing everything right in the way you think about mid-century planners doing things to entice residents. So where Pittsburgh's South Side, there's sort of rapid gentrification in the early 1990s, that's intended to serve the interests of young white-collar workers. North End development didn't do this. It didn't create luxury housing. It didn't attract young professionals. It remained primarily working class and continues today to house new immigrant groups as they arrive in the city. Because Hamilton's political culture acknowledged sort of a plurality of community interests, North End residents, though, continued to look to the city government to meet their need for basic services. And this, I think, is very different than in Pittsburgh and other American cities at the time, where the, you know, local political culture is encouraging residents to pursue self-help options through community development corporations and business organizations, rather than think that the city is going to be able to continue to provide them with services. So why do these similar visions for post-Steele neighborhoods in Pittsburgh and Hamilton end up so differently? You know, so as I keep saying, it seems like to me, until the neighborhood steel mill shuts down, the South Side largely resists gentrification, and through these neighborhood-based planning exercises that are partially funded but not supervised, really, by the city planning department, small business owners, social service agencies, and residents who are primarily retired or laid-off white ethnic manufacturing workers created a blueprint for neighborhood revitalization through historic preservation, and an informal economic development policy that helped existing business owners and homeowners improve their properties. After the mill shuts down, as I've been saying, right, this conflict emerges between business owners through the Southside Chamber of Commerce, old and new residents, steel workers from the region about what's going to happen with the site. And when reindustrialization becomes impossible on the site, the city steps in and redirects, you know, attention to the South Side for the first time in decades in a concerted way, and facilitates this public-private redevelopment of the mill site. So that the city's involvement becomes very decisive. But when it was sort of a hands-off approach, there were much more pluralistic sense of who was being served in the neighborhood. In Hamilton, local and provincial authorities intended the North End Renewal Project to serve the interests of the people who lived there. The planners hoped, though, to expand the North End's residential base to include professionals who they expected to work downtown. City officials never intended to displace blue-collar residents and replace them with white-collar residents, but instead they hoped to reclaim on or underutilized harborfront industrial land for luxury apartments. This scheme certainly did not prioritize granting existing residents access to the harbor, but it did seek to improve services and amenities for existing residents. So you see sort of a difference in the role of the city here, I think, being kind of essential. So I'd like to end today by noting one of the themes of my larger projects, which this mill neighborhood redevelopment reflects. One of the most important lessons to be learned, I think, from Pittsburgh and Hamilton's, you know, so-called post-industrial redevelopment is that in the late 20th century, there was a really limited set of ideas about how to address perceived urban decline. And because of this, consultants, planners, government and private sector officials increasingly turned to a best practices model for urban redevelopment, regardless of what their local conditions are and what their local regulations are. And I think, you know, in Pittsburgh, that best practice, Pittsburgh sort of makes the best practices model in a lot of ways, but it doesn't fit a place like Hamilton. Yet they're still trying to do the same thing, operating through the types of structures that they have. And obviously, that doesn't always, you know, work out so well when the institutional realities of what you're trying to do are very much in conflict with your imagination of what you'd like the city to be. I'll stop there. I've been droning on for a while. I forgot to show you Hamilton Harvey. Sorry, this is. I wanted to show you Hamilton does not look very different than it did before. Different angle, and there's a nice swan, but
yeah,
that's steering clear of the smoke. But yeah, there's Hamilton today.
Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
I want to thank Tracy for a very stimulating, exciting talk. We had last week. We were missing some. Evan Stoddard was here last week. And too bad he's not here, because Evan is part of that huge history of the South Side, of the South Side Planning Forum, of South Side Local Development Corporation, and what you kind of, well, I think a lot of us will have some comments and questions, but can we open it up? One other thing before people leave, make sure you grab our speaker series, because we have one in exactly 1 month. We've got two left. Dave Bartelt from Temple is going to be here. Go ahead, Michael.
Tracy, thanks very much for your talk. I've got about 30 questions.
Okay.
I'll go to a question and a comment. The comment first, it seems very much, what I was reminded of through your talk is the notion that's popularized in political geography these days of contingent neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Which is that notion that the essentializing character of a lot of the research in on neoliberalism is somewhat flawed. And overlooks a lot of the geographically specific context that drives the outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit to how you see your work sitting within that context. But my question is this. The word consultancy really pricked up my ears in terms of the transfer of policies and best practices in different periods. And you mentioned Hamilton's experience with this in an early period. I wonder if you've looked into those consultants and where else they were promoting those same best practices back in the mid-20th century.
Yeah, it's really funny that you asked that, because that was when of course, my dissertation project that's becoming the book, and my advisor the whole time was like, write more about the consultants, and I said, I cannot research the consultants on top of everything else. But some of them are actually coming to Pittsburgh and Hamilton both. There was this guy, Patrick Horsberg, who in the 60s came to both places and produced lighting plans for both cities. He's out of North Dakota or something. Hamilton was typically hiring planners out of Toronto. Sometimes they were hiring planners who had clearly worked in places like Phoenix, because they also saw themselves as very much competing with Sunbelt cities for industry when they were in a mood where they were acknowledging that they were trying to get industry. So you can definitely see, I mean, they weren't hiring McKinsey or whatever, but they're hiring big companies that are certainly working in other cities. And you can see like moments of that, because they'll refer to, as we showed you in our report that we produced for Calgary, which they must have done earlier and showed them when they were getting the bid, these kinds of things. So you can see that there's this kind of transnational network of these consultants, even in the 60s, that are moving around. And actually, when I get to work on a second project, that's sort of what I want to do. I want to look at these kinds of consultants more, so hopefully I'll be able to answer that better, because it is really interesting the way they're kind of moving around. The contingent neoliberalism question, I'm having a really hard time this month in particular deciding how I feel about neoliberalism, because when I started off with this is what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to look at Pittsburgh and Hamilton as different ways that neoliberal urbanism happens, right? That they're moving towards the same kind of model, but the way this is being rolled out or rolled back or whatever language you want to use happens differently and at different times in different places. And this is why we can't say that neoliberalism comes out of the New York City fiscal crisis or Phoenix, which is apparently where people think it's coming from now, these kinds of things. And I'm starting to get to the point where I'm not even sure I want to use the term, because I don't know. Half of me wants to historicize it and make a really good argument about why it's a really useful term, and part of me wants to say maybe in the urban context it's not the most useful way to think about these things, because there is so much continuity, even going back to kind of the 1920s, about the way businessmen are interacting with cities and the kinds of public-private partnerships that are happening. So what I'll say is, you're catching me in a very indecisive moment about this, and it's apparently the thing I need to figure out over my spring break so I can get back to writing the book. But I'm really struggling with how much to, first I was like, I'm going to reperiodize this, and I'm going to, show all this stuff, and then maybe I shouldn't even be using this term.
What are your sources for the analysis of the South Side?
A lot of it is, hopefully it's, I will get some new ones now that the SSLBC's papers are at the public library, but it's mainly planning reports and there's a bunch of stuff at the Pitt Archives and various other collections. So since I couldn't get anyone at the city planning department to talk to me at the time, I basically had planning reports and sort of newsletters that these neighborhood groups or these, you know, CDCs had produced that are stuck away, you know, squirreled away in some of the what the heck are they called, the Tri-State Conference and some of the SBA papers. Mm-hmm. So it's this mismatch of things where, you know, it's things that they had collected that I'd gotten a hold of. And then, of course, the Southside Library has a little bit of a collection on its own development. So mainly it's these formal plans and newsletters. Am I supposed to be calling up people?
Yeah, right. I'm curious if you, in your analysis, came across or tried to quantify the state of civil society organizations and I don't have a sense of how that was in Hamilton, and I do know that in working in both countries, they always say, we wish we had the foundation community that you have. We wish we had the nonprofit community that you have. And so I know that there are some big differences.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone basically wishes they had the foundation community that Pittsburgh had. I mean, Pittsburgh has a foundation community like nothing but New York. It's kind of insane how much foundation money is here, you know. And, I mean, Detroit has nothing like that, despite, you know, Ford. But, yeah, no, I didn't try to quantify it because, you know, numbers and historians. But no, it's, you know, Hamilton, starting in 1968, basically sends a delegation down to Pittsburgh every 5 to 10 years to talk to the Allegheny Conference. And so it's their letters, you know, thanking them and telling them what they liked about the visitor all sitting here. And every single letter mentions the foundation funding. And so Canada generally does not have a strong foundation sector. Pittsburgh has no foundations. One of the big differences is that the two big steel companies there, Richard DeFasco and Stelco, they will donate money for kind of philanthropic projects or, you know, cultural development. But they had no interest in this downtown redevelopment or whatever. There's no kind of formal public-private partnership, and this, Canada doesn't have the same history of neighborhood organizing either. And so this group I mentioned in 1977, this North End Residential Organization, is one of the first of its kind in Hamilton in 1977, and it's very ad hoc. Even though Hamilton's winning awards in the 70s for having kind of a U.S.-style community planning model where they have community meetings and people can come and talk to them, they just don't have this kind of organizing, and everything is very ad hoc. Like, people will, as they do here, you know, you'll organize if someone wants to put a highway through your house, but then you stop caring about it once they either have or haven't put the highway through your house and you move on. But you don't have anything like the CDCs here. So it becomes a very uneven story in a lot of ways for that. The capacity is just so much different. But at the same time, I think in Pittsburgh, nobody expects the mayor or the city council to care what they think in Pittsburgh. And in Hamilton, they really do. They've got a weak mayor and a strong city council, and the councilors really will advocate for neighborhood interests. So I think at the same time, they didn't see the need as much to organize that way, because they would just go to city council meetings and yell at their councilor and actually stop.
I'll do a little challenge here, maybe because Evan's not here.
I will appreciate that.
Yeah. You might be, and this is a little bit with Michael's question, you might be a little ahead of your time frame on the South Side.
Because
The URA bought that steel mill site to put gambling on it.
Yeah.
And that was a huge point of conflict with the neighborhood. Evan was not only involved with the South Side Planning Forum and helping to start Southside Local Development Corporation, but was active in No Dice. Mm-hmm. And there was a big opposition to that site and the city. So the city, you know, your neoliberalism theory isn't kind of dovetailing with some of the things that are going on. Empirically, the Southside doesn't get a house that sells for $100,000 till the end of the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s.
Yeah.
The Southside Local Development Corporation's first forays into housing, Edwards Court, they had huge $50,000 gaps between the price of construction and what we've got some bankers here, what the banks thought they could sell them for. You know, so you've got this,
yeah.
I mean, your argument about this gentrification in the 1990s just seems ahead of the curve to me.
Yeah.
They still had declining population. They still were an aging place. That housing that the CDC did was the first housing built there
mm-hmm.
in 100 years. Market housing doesn't come in until much, much
mm-hmm.
later.
I think that's a good point, and I don't disagree with any of that. I talk about the gambling stuff a bit in the project. But I think maybe a better way to say it is that they start moving towards an approach that's going to bring on gentrification, rather than it's gentrifying in the early 1990s. It's that there seems to be this kind of sharp shift when they realize that the city's interested and wants to influence what's going on, and to figuring out, at least, like, I was looking at some letters that were, in these files. It seems like they've got this notion that the city's going to get involved, and that they better figure out how their vision for the neighborhood can work for the neighborhood residents, and also, like, not undermine this kind of Renaissance vision of Pittsburgh. But that's not, you're right, that's not the same thing as gentrification. That's starting to think about, it's the wrong language.
Yeah,
yeah.
They thought that the city pulled out too fast in
yeah.
Birmingham. I mean, and
yeah.
the market didn't hold.
Mm-hmm.
They sat there with the property, and the developer sat for many more years than they ever thought they would. So, your timing is a little, I think, uneven. For
yeah.
I mean, they also, I mean, if Rick Belilli were here, they eventually see the Carson Street as the local serving
mm-hmm.
area former steel site, the South Side Works, as the regional
yeah.
draw. So they really start to differentiate that, which should come through in the notes of their meetings, too.
Yeah.
I think that was a long discussion in the planning forum. But
yeah, no, it does, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm
they
not
start
emphasizing
to see, like,
that well.
Serving, they really want their neighborhood
yeah.
to be able to serve two markets.
Yeah. It's a massive discussion they're having, you're right. Like this conversation. Yeah. Yeah, I need to be more explicit about that.
And Bob sat on the board there, so he probably...
So did Mark.
And
Mark
is on, and you're still all involved in it. So we got some other people that might want to add some things.
Yes,
there.
Which is good to hear. I am open to hearing the ways in which I am wrong. I really
not
am.
Right.
So, or odd, for what I need to think about. So this is why I was nervous to come talk in Pittsburgh.
But we're a nice group.
You are a nice
yeah.
group, right?
Mark?
I think there was lots of evolution and lots of talk about planning, but market-driven that overtook a lack of it happened. There were planners, but I think it evolved. Would you agree with that, Bob? There might have been a big vision, but I didn't see it. There were lots of little visions and lots of controversy.
Mm-hmm.
The old residents, the new residents, the houses that my mom bought for $25,000 now selling for $180,000,
mm-hmm.
same house. No one planned that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the market
yeah.
kind of overtook
the
vision.
The market overtook
the
vision.
90s,
great way to put it.
The late 90s is when things really started to take off in the private market.
Absolutely, and that took over. The market just took over.
Yeah, well, it went from, I think, like, if you look back and you say, well, you know, there are probably a lot of things, oh, had we known this, we would have probably done a lot of things
sure.
to prepare. But
sure.
the organization had no concept that
mm-hmm.
you know that house for $25,000 was going to sell for $180,000.
Right.
They thought, well, you know, if we're successful, maybe $50,000-$60,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe one way to think about it is not to think about, maybe I am imputing what I can see looking back in hindsight as being the intentions of the people involved. When it's unintentional, it's just that what is happening is the same thing that happens in many other places that we now know leads to a certain outcome, but that. Who would have known that in 1985?
You said earlier that Hamilton now acts as a suburb of Toronto. Could you talk about that a little more, how their economy might be connected?
Yeah, so they actually do regional planning in Canada. So there's this regional plan in the 1960s that basically says that, you know, there's going to be this manufacturing belt, and Hamilton is the center of this manufacturing belt. Toronto is going to be it's the finance center of the country for the most part, right? But it's going to be the finance and commercial center of southern Ontario. And then the suburbs in between the two are some of them are going to be commercial, some of them are going to be residential, some of them are going to be a little bit more manufacturing. And so you end up with this weird kind of, like, there's Burlington is the big real rival for Hamilton. It also used to be industrial, but because it is closer to Toronto, it is allowed to become less industrial, and it's, you know, this kind of gorgeous suburban riverfront development with all sorts of, you know, it's the suburban, like, dining area for the Toronto area. But there, you know, as far as the links between their economies, as far as I understand it, basically what's happening is there's a light rail that goes to Toronto, and so a lot of young, you know, workers who can't afford to live in Toronto and aren't willing to live in that the god-awful, you know, like, miles and miles of townhouse development around Toronto. Yeah, that if you watch HGTV, it's like all you ever see on HGTV in these Toronto suburbs. They're all living in, like, one area that's walkable to the train station, the Lark Street area in Hamilton, and they've got a Starbucks there now, and they've got a co-op you can get, you know. So it's those sorts of things, right? And they just take the train into Toronto to work. But for the most part, they stay in that one neighborhood, and they get on the train and go to Toronto to work and come back. And the city is now trying to promote an expansion of that. But they also, you know, Toronto also has McMaster University, so there's a huge student population in a student area. It has been sort of, the uses have remained kind of spatially segregated compared to, I think, American cities. And then they did, you know, they finally, both of the steel mills were bought out, one by U.S. Steel and one by, I don't remember, a German corporation maybe, or Japanese, someone else who still makes steel. Yeah. Yeah, and they're not, U.S. Steel put up an American flag and then shut it down, basically. It was this weird colonial move. So, you know, they didn't have a lot of manufacturing workers left, despite a lot of production, and there's still a lot of light industry and kind of machining and that sort of stuff. But, so I don't know, there's sort of the notion that the links between Toronto and Hamilton are such that they're serving specific roles in this provincial growth model. But as far as beyond that, it's just cheap and looks like Toronto in this neighborhood, you know, like it's pretty houses and it's way cheaper than Toronto.
When you say way cheaper than Toronto, how cheap is that?
It's not as cheap as here. So Hamilton actually has the most expensive, not as cheap as Detroit. It has the most expensive property taxes in Canada, which is sort of insane. But you could buy, like, in this Lark Street area, if you were to get a 2-bedroom condo. I don't know, 5 years ago, I haven't looked at property values since. I should pull Zillow up or something. But it was probably a quarter of the cost of Toronto. Because, you know,
I see all the HGTV shows my wife always watches.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to pay that much just to be in Toronto? But, you know, I guess it's a big real estate one.
Yeah. That's the thing. And it doesn't seem to be bursting. It's insane. So, yeah, no, I'd say it's probably at least a quarter, but the taxes are higher.
Okay.
If you're thinking of moving. Yeah.
Right? That's a long commute. Yeah.
Well, and if no one else has a question or a comment, there are only a few of us who are both old and born Pittsburghers here, but I swear that Chinese on Carson was once considered exotic food in Pittsburgh.
That's funny.
I have one question about the policies for redevelopment. Since Canada doesn't permit economic poaching.
Yes.
Did you see any evidence of kind of ground-up economic development and alternatives to just seeing, you know, what the big boys can swing around?
No, and the thing that's really weird is, I mean, you see a little bit of it in the way that you would in any big neighborhood-based stuff, but the thing that's really weird is they do it anyway. Like, they're told they can't, and they repeatedly told, they get cease and desist letters from, like, the Provincial Economic Development Authority or whatever, telling them to stop trying, you know, stop contacting this company in Oakville to see if they want to move there. You can't do this. And they just keep doing it. This is where I was saying, like, the lack of imagination, I think, becomes problematic, because, like Rust Belt cities in the U.S., they see themselves as locked into competing over, you know, American branch plants that are going to Mexico and to the U.S. South. And so they can't think outside of that. There's never kind of an indigenous, other than, you know, oh, we're going to build some headquarters buildings and they will come kind of thing. Stelco, the big steel company, they move their headquarters to Toronto. And they spend a lot of time trying to get the headquarters back. If finally they're like, fine, we'll give you, you know, one floor of, you know, back office functions or something for downtown. But you don't really, in a way that's really surprising. Not until much later, you know, now you kind of do. Partially because they've got this new market, yeah, that they're trying to attract. But it really kind of, it just kind of remains amazing that no matter how many times they're told, you can't offer incentives. You can't, you know, you can't do smoke stack chasing. You can't do this. You can't do that. They just keep doing it.
Wild, wild north.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
Did you
get a question?
Well, I'm from the regional planning organization, so I'll pretend to be offended by what you said, but I'm not.
Oh, no. Well, don't you guys try to have regional planning? You just get stymied, right?
Trying.
Home rule.
So, secondly, I have the I have a copy of the Southside Works Vision document at home. We found when we moved, dug up somewhere. Pittsburgh is actually going to have one more round of urban renewal, I guess you would call it, and as you talked about Hamilton, it started to make me think what we're going to do on the Strip District is looking a little bit more like that kind of a model, where the industry is kind of still there, and the questions of how to incorporate that, you know, something that still exists into what is kind of a more top down, not just from the city but from the region that's coming up with this plan. And then the other difference is I didn't hear you talk about neither of these spots, the Southside Works or Hamilton, seemed interested in a transportation approach to this. I mean, if they wanted to attract new residents, but it didn't occur to them to say, okay, let's put in a light rail.
Yeah.
In neither places,
they have a light rail. They have light rail in Canada, so that's already kind of there. But they don't see it linking up to the North End. It only goes to downtown. And they don't talk about expanding transportation beyond buses. They just assume people will drive, right? It's the same sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think that Toronto is good with transportation, but I think the rest of Southern Ontario is kind of on the U.S. model with transportation.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for coming. It's been great, Tracy. Thank
good
you
seeing
for
you. Good
coming
to see
from
you.
Detroit, and okay, I think we all have lots of more, probably have some more questions for you.
Yeah, no, I would love that. Yeah, if anyone wants to write to me privately and tell me where I'm going wrong, I'm not kidding. Like, if you think I've got something way off, I would love to hear that because it will save me some embarrassment down the road. I would be really open
thank
to
you.
That. So.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks for listening.